Welcome to the Stick Boy Podcast. I'm Joel Johnson, and today is a very special episode. It's been a long time coming. We used to do videos, and then we stopped doing videos, and we kind of talked about doing a podcast again, and now here we are doing a podcast. It's Trinity? The Trinity? Which one was it again?
Trinity's fine.
So
yeah,
it,
we can go with Trinity.
So we... Trinity was a videos that we would shoot, which would feature myself and my two co-host guests, people that stand here and talk more than I do, Anthony Torres and Jesse Mully, both SAIT grads. And we had done videos talking about video games, and I guess now we go back and do that all over again, and this is episode one. So how are you guys doing?
Good.
I'm good.
What's new? What's been new in your lives?
Not a whole lot. Just busy.
Busy?
School and stuff like that, work.
Yeah.
Good. Anthony moved to Brandon, Manitoba.
Did. I moved away. And
yeah,
it's been the journey. It's been interesting. I've been liking it so far. So
that's why we can just do a video format of this, is because...
Yeah.
Two of us are in Alberta and one of us is in Manitoba. So that'd be quite a trek for one of us to make it to the other spot. I mean, it's doable, but maybe we'll have to find a middle point for us. So like I said, we're going to be talking video games, and this has been an incredible year for video games. At least I feel like this has been a really good year for video games.
Yes.
And I mean, we know that Jesse sits there and plays his Xbox, and I may have a little bit of bias against Xbox, but we'll get into that a little bit. But I think the main point that we wanted to talk about today was one of my favorite superheroes, and I think it's one of Anthony's favorite superheroes, if not
yeah,
his favorite.
Yeah.
Did record sales for PlayStation, and I platinumed the game. Anthony platinumed it first. He helped me get to the platinum trophy. It's Spider-Man. So, how did you feel? Jesse, do you, for starters, know anything about the gameplay or any of the story for Spider-Man?
I know that the game Spider-Man, the one we're talking about, I'm assuming is the one for the PlayStation 4 that just came out.
Yes.
Yeah, that game pretty much just told EA to go shove it, because it was a completely single-player game that managed to do very good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think
without microtransactions and without forced multiplayer, you know what I mean? They EA once said that they don't think single player games are good anymore and they won't sell as much. And now that I look at Spider-Man, I gotta laugh because I just got proven wrong.
Well, I mean,
yep,
you can make that argument that earlier this year EA got proven wrong with the God of War game that had come out for the PlayStation 4. And I think that there really is a pushback for more single-player platforms. I myself prefer single players. I prefer just kind of locking into the game and going off and playing. And I think that was one of the things with this Spider-Man game. And just before we get into everything, there are going to be spoilers, Jesse, so I hope you're okay with that. But I'm sure you'll be fine with it. Anthony, what'd you think of the game? Overall, how'd you feel about what they did? Because I know that when the trailer came out to now, there was a lot of pressure on this game to deliver and be a very good Spider-Man game. Do you think it lived up to the expectations? Was it underwhelming to you at any points? What are your thoughts?
So, it was teased at E3 in, I want to say, 2015.
I think it was either 15 or 16 that it got teased.
15 or 16, one of those two. So it's been a long time coming. I think it was kind of announced that there's going to be a game in 15, but I think it was 16 where we got our first trailer.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time coming for this game. Overall, the game, I feel, met the expectations and what people thought it was going to be. It actually exceeded certain aspects, in my opinion. Like, if we were to talk about the mechanics of the game, it definitely made you feel as though you were Spider-Man swinging through the city of New York, which to me was really well done. And I thought that was fantastic, that a game could make you feel so a part of the environment and the area around you. And I thought that was just awesome. Story-wise, it was phenomenal. The storyline was so cool, and it was really, really well done. I did have some issues with some of the side missions. But the only thing with the side missions was, like, the actual side missions themselves were another part of the story, which was awesome. Those were really cool and really well done. And then you had the different camps, whether it was the Fisk hideout, the Demon hideout, Sable outposts, prisoner camps. Those were a lot of fun, and I was okay with those because each different district had either one or two that you had to do, which was fine. It was, in my opinion, the right amount. And then you get into the Taskmaster challenges were fun, but they were also, like, in order to get the best one possible, you had to do a lot of grinding in order just to be like, hey, this is the highest level I can get in it. And you had to do a lot of grinding in order just to get there, which is okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I love games that make you grind for stuff, and because overall it makes you better at the end of the day. The backpack thing, that was really cute. And I think that was definitely just a ton of Easter eggs at the end of the day. And I was good with that. I thought that was awesome. The only thing that kind of lacked for me was when they made you do, in each district, you had regular crime, demon crime, Sable, and the prisoners. And I think that's all of them, because there was five in total. Yeah. And each one required you to do it five times. That was very repetitive. Especially after the first, like, couple districts, I would be like, okay, I'm kind of over this now, you know?
Yeah, it was one of those things in the game where once you get off the raft, and then suddenly you have all these popping up, and you're like, okay, here's the rest to complete each district. And this was one of the games that I was definitely trying to chase a platinum trophy for.
Mm-hmm.
From working the top to bottom, this was a very long grind for 100%ing the district. But it was frustrating, because once you've kind of done it a couple times, like you said, it's like, okay, I've done this a couple times, give me something else to kind of work with here. And I found that some of the bonus points, like, you could do if you completed, like, web bombed certain people or did a swing kick, then you'd get an extra token out of it. I found those to be a little frustrating at different times, because I'd be like, okay, what do I have to kind of complete here? Okay, oh, this is gonna be a bit of a pain. And then you go and try to do it, and you try to complete it, then you're like, okay, got it done. And then you go back and you're like, oh, I gotta do this all over again, just with this there. And there would be only one token change, like, there would be one challenge that'd be like, you've got to do this now. That was the only part of the game that really kind of left me a little bit more like, okay, is this done yet? Because I want to get to the end of the story. And like you said, the story overall, the arcing story from Mr. Negative to Doc Ock's descension into madness, to going after Norman Osborn, to eventually the climactic end where you face Doc Ock, and then you have to deal with the ramifications of what Doc Ock's done. I found at times it was a little bit of a pain because I wanted to get to that. And Jesse, do you know any major plot points to the end of the game at all?
No.
So I want to get your reaction to this, and then this is a spoiler. So one of the main plot points for the game was, it was called Devil's Breath. It was something developed by Osborn, and Doc Ock got his meat hooks into it, and he released it onto the city of New York. And at that time, Aunt May worked at, it's called Feast, which is basically a spot for homeless people or people kind of down on their luck. And when this got released, she kind of helped drive Feast forward to help deal with situations of people that were infected. And while dealing with that, she had to deal with people that were getting infected, and in turn, she got infected. But she kept kind of working because they needed her to work. And in the end, Spider-Man defeats Doc Ock and gets the cure for it, and he has the choice of either giving Aunt May the cure or keeping the cure to cure everyone else, because Aunt May is close to death. And in the end, Spider-Man makes the hard choice of keeping the cure for everyone else, and Aunt May passes away. And one of the final shots in the game is you see Uncle Ben and May Parker's gravestones together. How do you feel about that?
You know, I've been subjected to so much, like, I don't want to say edgy, but so much, what is it, like, oh, like, when the hero or a significant other of the hero dies, I don't really feel anything anymore, because I've seen this cliche so many times in past movies and games.
So this has no impact on you?
No, okay. Not really.
Hang on a sec. Let me just backtrack it a bit. Joel actually missed some crucial parts to the story. Like, okay, yes, bottom line, Norman Osborn did release the Devil's Breath. And then at the start of the game, though, let's not forget Otto Octavius is a good guy, okay? He starts off good, and you don't see anything wrong with him, okay? As the story progresses, it's Mr. Negative who is acting all out and doing these crazy things and going against the police and trying to stop Norman and kill Norman, essentially. Okay? Norman hires a company called Sable. And they essentially are his bodyguards, right? So what ends up happening with Sable is they're there to protect Norman and keep him safe because everyone's after him. But he hasn't released the Devil's Breath yet. The Devil's Breath is still in their, what's it called? Their research lab. Because it's actually Mr. Negative who releases the Devil's Breath.
No, it's Doc Ock in Times Square. Yeah.
Right. Okay, yeah, because Doc Ock goes crazy, gets his arms because he has issues. He doesn't get funding for his stuff anymore, and then suddenly Otto gets the arms.
And the cerebral messes with his mind.
And then he becomes Dr. Octopus, right?
Yeah.
And then, so he releases it because when you're Peter Parker, you defeat Mr. Negative, put him in the raft, and then all's good, okay? So you think. And then Otto goes and releases all the bad guys, and he forms his own Sinister Six, which is Dr. Octopus, Mr. Negative, Scorpion, Vulture, Electro, and Rhino. So that's his.
Well, Kraven the Hunter.
Kraven's not there, and that's, it's led by Otto, and Mr. Negative basically replaces Kraven in this form of the Sinister Six. Because there's technically a lot of forms of the Sinister Six, if we really wanted to talk about that. So what ends up happening is Otto releases the Devil's Breath, whatever, whatever, and then you have to go and stop everybody, so you go and fight Vulture and Scorpion together, or no, Vulture and Electro, and then you fight Rhino and Scorpion, and then you go fight Mr. Negative by yourself, and then you fight Dr. Octopus. And also, in doing all of this, you do find out that Norman and Otto work together, and they're the ones who created Oscorp, and they were doing tests on Martin Lee, which becomes Mr. Negative. So Otto already knew about this stuff, and then, you know, so the whole thing is like, it starts way from back then, but like they show you lots of flashbacks, and it's really cool. Like the storyline is really well done, in my opinion.
Oh yeah.
And then you have this super, super emotional fight with Otto Octavius, and he gives you one of like the best lines in the whole thing, in that scene when after you beat Otto, he's laying on top of a table, and he can't move because you disarmed his arms and, like, you stopped him from being able to use them. So he actually can't function. Because they hint at him having, I can't remember the specific...
A neuromuscular disorder.
Yes. He's having issues moving his arms and stuff, right?
Okay.
So you have this very emotional scene with Otto laying on the table, and Otto's like, he knows you're Peter Parker, by the way. He knows Peter Parker is Spider-Man. He figured it out. And he goes, he says to Peter, I thought of you as my son. You meant everything to me, and you betrayed me like everyone else does. And Peter was like, I didn't betray you. You betrayed me. I thought of you as like a father figure. You were super important to me. I looked up to you, and I wanted to change the world for good with you. But you went against everything we stood for. And it was like, it was just a super emotional scene. And then eventually you see the whole thing with Aunt May. I do agree. It is very cliche. However, it wasn't shocking, nor was it like something new, but it did also, in that whole slew of emotions, it does make you feel something.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing with this is it may be cliched, but for the first time in like a major platform for a Spider-Man storyline, you get to see now what Spidey Peter Parker's like without Aunt May and Uncle Ben. Both have passed away, and now you live in a world now where both of them are gone, and you get to see how that character develops. That's something that, at least to me, hasn't been done on a major platform yet, and for them to on a major platform is going to be interesting because the story's going to have a different feel to it, but at the same time, it's still a Spider-Man story.
The biggest thing, though, that happens with Spider-Man a lot of the times is we start from when he was younger, and you always see the whole cliche Uncle Ben dying and that impacting him and whatever. Whereas this video game actually takes place well after that's happened, well after he's done high school, well after him and Mary Jane have been together. Like, they're actually not even together in the beginning of this game, or at the end of the game, really. So it's a really interesting take, and it's like an older version of Spider-Man that, like, he's been doing this for so long that you see in the comics.
Yeah, you see...
You don't question and go, wow, what's the backstory? Why is he here? What's he doing? Like, we already know these things based off all the movies we've seen, if that's all you've seen, or even the cartoon shows. Like, it just picks up on an everyday life in Peter Parker / Spider-Man.
Spider-Man's...
I mean, there's just so many different Spider-Mans now. Like, there's all these different universes, different realities and timelines that... I'm getting confused and convoluted. Like, there's a Marvel Zombies. There's one where the Venom symbiote takes over completely. Like, I don't know. I'm kind of lost in all of it.
Yeah, but okay, that has nothing to do with this game specifically. That's just Marvel in general competing with DC and trying to make something new all the time. Because DC does the same thing too, and can't argue that. There's like several different versions of Batman and Superman, blah, 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 and the list just goes on. Like, it's just every superhero has like 10 different storylines.
Yeah, comics as a whole can get very convoluted with the attention to detail, and that's why you mentioned it, and that's why something that I like about Spider-Man is you can delve into a Spider-Man game like this, or you could jump into a Spider-Man movie, and I think the origin story has been told enough that you have an idea what's happening, and as long as they're good storytellers that are working on the project, then you'll be able to pick up on Spider-Man's universe with Aunt May, Mary Jane, Miles Morales now, and just the different villains, and you can figure the story out, and it is one of the things that I do like about Spider-Man is I feel like Spider-Man's one of those characters that you can jump into at different points and you don't feel as lost. The Spider-Verse can convolute things and cause some issues, but as long as you know who the main Peter Parker is, then you should be good.
Yeah, I mean, it does get very tricky with Peter Parker in general and, like, what they do within the comics, but, like, that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, and, I mean, we're going to see the Spider-Verse with Into the Spider-Verse.
Ooh, yeah, we can talk about that later, but I am kind of excited about that.
speaking of the Spider-Verse, there's one character in this game that I think could definitely be a big player and could potentially carry his own video game franchise at some point.
Miles Morales.
Yeah, depending on how the story goes. Jesse, you know about Miles Morales, correct?
Yeah, Ultimate Spider-Man. Yeah.
Yes. So, let's just say this. I was really happy to see that they included him in this game, and I thought that was awesome. And I thought that was a really smart move on their part. Okay? If we were to talk, also, with the game in general and, like, certain missions, to me, the Mary Jane missions were very meh. They weren't anything super exciting, super, like, wow, I want to keep doing this. They did have a lot of Easter eggs in those missions, so, like, they were semi-important. But overall missions with Mary Jane were very slow, and I just wasn't a big fan of them. Like, I understand why they had them, and it's great to include Mary Jane in the storyline and have her be a playable character.
I quite liked...
For me, though, the biggest thing that kind of lacked for me is, like, I'm playing Spider-Man, and I want to do crazy things and beat people up and shoot my webs and just do all those cool little tricks that they have where you do, like, web impact or bundle them up with a web and just, like, different things like that and use all the gadgets. Mary Jane's mission did not have that. You just had to be sneaky and hide. And they were stealth missions. Stealth missions aren't always horrible, but they're also sometimes good. There were some of them that were good and some weren't good. One of the ones that I found, like, semi-annoying was the one where you are in Oscorp building in the main lobby, and you basically have to distract all the guards so Spider-Man could take them out.
Yeah. That
mission. Boring.
Yeah, I wasn't as big on that one.
Right. The one where Mary Jane's in Oscorp's suite and you see all the different things in there. That one was cool. I liked that one. It was very engaging and intriguing, and there were so many different Easter eggs in there, and I thought that was awesome. The Miles missions, though, are very similar to Mary Jane's.
The only
difference between the two was, instead of Mary Jane throwing rocks or whatever it was to distract the guards, or the sound bomb things or whatever it was, Miles just distorted the intercoms and stuff and made noises so that they could go to it. Very similar to Mary Jane's missions, but there was less of them. And I thought that was okay.
Yeah.
Because it progressed the story in a better way. Because there wasn't too much of that. But when you did have the Miles, it had a sense of purpose, is what it felt like. And there was story behind it. And you learned more about the character alone.
Yeah, no.
So I thought that was really cool.
And, like, just as a side note for Jesse, this is actually really good to have Jesse here. During the story, Miles' dad gets killed by Mr. Negative, and Spider-Man wasn't able to make that save. He worked with Miles Morales' dad. Miles Morales' dad was going to get an award from the mayor, and Peter was there, not as Spider-Man, but as Peter Parker with MJ, and that's when this attack happened from Mr. Negative, and it knocks Spidey out, and that what led to Miles' dad dying a hero, because he tried to save others, and in doing that he took the brunt of the death. Norman Osborn got away safe, which was typical for Norman, but they did kill off Miles's father.
Who's Mr. Negative?
Martin Lee. He's one of the newer villains, I guess you could say. He's not, like, super popular because he wasn't in the older comics. Mr. Negative made his debut in one of the Amazing Spider-Man comics, like, from the run that was, like, 1 to 700, so, like, the most recent run that they did, if I recall correctly.
And he has the ability to make people give in, or just mind control to negative thoughts and more of their negative traits?
I would say it is mind control, in the sense that he basically runs the demon gang, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
So it's a Japanese type thing. It was Japanese?
Yes. I believe so.
And he had a, like, he has a demon mask, and it's actually really cool. And, like, he can manipulate people, is the best way to put it. Yeah, he can manipulate people into doing what he wants and takes control of them.
And you...
Go ahead, like an Oni mask? Like, you know, like the Japanese ogre?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay. I'll look him up in my spare time and see what he's about, but go on.
He, the Miles, having Miles in this game, I remember reading the first issue that Miles appears and just watching his progression in Ultimate Spider-Man and then the Ultimate comic book universe getting zapped away and him falling into the main Marvel universe and just how his character has grown. So to see him in a spot like this and to see him get bit by the spider.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
And one of the post-credit scenes is him jumping onto the wall with Peter and them having this awesome moment where they can bond over the changes that both of them had gone through. And how Miles is going to have a different take because he's got he has two different powers than what the original Spider-Man does. So it's going to be really neat to see that. But just to see that moment where they're both sticking on the wall and it's like, yes, this is what I wanted. This is fantastic. I'm excited for the next game. It was really neat to see.
Yeah, I was actually really excited. And I was really happy that they even included him in the game and have made him a substantial character and had significance to him.
Yeah, and you I think
it wasn't just one of his Easter eggs.
Yeah, I'm glad he wasn't just an Easter egg. I'm glad he played a role in Peter's the end game for Peter at the end.
Yeah.
The other character that, because there was a few characters that have little tweaks and changes. One of the characters that I liked their tweak and change was Mary Jane Watson. She's now a reporter for the Daily Bugle. And that's how her kind of missions play out, is she's kind of an investigative journalist. And I like that it wasn't just the typical, oh, I need Spider-Man to save me, help me. It was, she could kind of hold her own in some ways, not very much. She had to have Spidey come in at different points, because when you're dealing with supervillains, it's just the way it is. But she seemed like an interesting character that there's room to grow with her as a character than just having her be a love interest. There's more to her.
Yeah, I did appreciate that. They did change around a lot of the characters and made them a lot different than what we are used to seeing them as, and I thought that was really cool. Even, like, the villains, for example, you know, Otto Octavius, he starts off in his character development in this game, too, and Norman Osborn, and how he's so mysterious right now and how we don't really know a whole lot about him. I'm like, we do, but in the way the game is portrayed, it's kind of a mystery, you know?
Yeah. And that's a nice thing. And the other aspect to the game, because I do want to get to... there's three cutscenes I'd like to talk about before we move on. But the one little thing I'd like to note is it was pure brilliance having J. Jonah Jameson no longer on the Daily Bugle, but having a podcast that would be akin to Alex Jones, of him just ranting and raving about Spider-Man. And at different points of the game, you get J. Jonah Jameson's point of view on just what's happened with Spider-Man. And just random little side missions that you do, you'll get J. Jonah Jameson's opinion, and you can collect the podcast as you go along. I thought that was a really brilliant, smart way to keep J. Jonah Jameson throughout the game, but you don't have to see him at any point.
Yep. And not just that, all the, like, little newspaper clippings and just the collectibles in general were really cool. And, like, even the photography missions, those were fun, where you had to go take pictures of the landmarks and even all the little Easter eggs inside those landmarks, like the New York Sanctum, Grand Enterprises, the Murdoch and Nelson lawyer place, like, just all these little things like that was really cool to see.
Yeah, and
you get... Yeah, the Avengers Tower was awesome.
You had to sit on top of there and wonder if they were home or not.
Yeah, and that was one of the trophies, was just perching on top of the Avenger Tower, and I was like, that is really clever.
No, I quite liked what they did with the Avengers Tower. I thought that that was a moment that I really, really liked. And I thought the game as a whole was just, I really like this game as a fan of Marvel and as a fan of just the storyline. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And the Easter eggs were really well done. The Stan Lee Easter egg was awesome.
Oh, the Jesse, if you get the time, you should see the Stan Lee cameo that they have in this one, because it was brilliant, and I loved it.
Yeah.
Overall, I thought this... What would you give this game before we get to the post-credit scenes?
Out of what?
Out of 10.
Like, out of 10? I would definitely say 8.5 out of 10.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. 8.5. I thought the story was very strong. There was a little bit of repetitiveness, like you said, with the side missions. But I think overall, that last bit of the game when you battle Doc Ock and you build that other the Ock suit and you go to face him, and that whole couple cutscenes afterward were just home runs. And I think I'm excited to see what the DLC brings, and just...
Oh, I'm excited for the DLC.
The expansion of the universe. Now, there was one thing that a lot of fans were hoping to see at different points, but just never popped in, and that was the Venom suit. But thanks to the two post-credit scenes, we kind of have an idea of where things are going. So, Anthony, what was the first post-credit scene?
So the first one, if I recall...
Involves some sticking to walls.
Yeah, so the first post-credit scene has Miles and Peter. And then...
cute little moment.
And that fantastic moment where Miles goes, "Oh, Peter, I need to talk to you about something." And Peter's like, "Oh, yeah, sure." And he goes, "Well, don't tell my mom. It's not something I can talk to her about. It's about my body. And Peter, I'm going through some changes." And Peter's like, thinking it's about puberty. And then he's like, "Oh, my body." He's like, "Oh, when you hit a certain age, you know, your body starts to change." And Miles is like, no, not like that. And he goes to, like, I think it was, like, kind of adjust himself. And then Peter thinks he's taking his shirt off. And he's like, "Whoa, oh, my God." And then Miles jumps up on his roof. And he goes, "Kind of weird, hey?" And then Peter smiles, jumps on the roof, too, and goes, "No, it's not that weird." That was awesome. Okay. And then, after all that, the next post-credit scene, which is beautiful because it's perfect Marvel fashion that they would have two post-credit scenes, is Norman Osborn walking into his secret lab that he has in his suite, opens up the middle, which also, by the way, Jesse, just so you're aware, Harry Osborn has been absent from this game because everybody believes he's been in Europe. He was supposed to go to Europe on just to get away because he was feeling sick or something. So his dad, Norman, sent him away to Europe. Okay. Quote unquote Europe. That's where he went. Okay. So in the post-credit scene, this one, Norman goes into his lab, his secret lab, opens up this box that's in the middle, and it opens up and there's green liquid inside, and there's Harry Osborn laying in the middle of this water, like in this water. Right. And inside is all this black goo that's surrounding him. Okay. Norman Osborn walks up and he goes, "Don't worry, Harry." I think it's something along the lines like, "Don't worry, Harry, I'm going to try and fix you and make you better." And he puts his hand against the glass, and this little black goo that looks like a hand suddenly attaches to the glass, implying that Harry has the Venom symbiote attached to him.
All right.
So, just a little backstory on that. In the Ultimate Universe, the Black Symbiote didn't come from space. It came from it was Norman Osborn and Harry's Peter's father that worked on creating this. It was supposed to be a cure for cancer, and then that what led to the Venom coming in was just they made that, and the symbiote morphed into what became a into this. So that potentially could be how this plays out. I know that there has been a storyline where Harry Osborn is the first Venom. So I'm very interested to see that, especially with Harry sick and potentially dying. The choices now, if he is in the Venom suit in the second game, and just what Peter might have to make for choices and what that could mean for if Harry lives or dies or not. The other interesting part, and this is just purely speculation, but the green stuff in this is believed to be Oz, which in the Ultimate Spider-Man universe is what it was, a chemical created that was almost like a super soldier serum that was used, and it was what's in the spiders that bit Miles and Peter. And because it was a small dose and because it came through the spider, it didn't kill them or make them go crazy, but Norman takes a full dose of it and he becomes like this goblin monster. So the speculation is, if something terrible happens to Harry in the second game, then that could send Norman down a very dark path that could lead him to ultimately becoming the Green Goblin. Because in Norman's office, you get the Easter egg of a helmet that can detect structural weaknesses. And within, I believe it was the helmet, you can see that the helmet's to be paired with a glider. I saw mm-hmm. that a couple days ago on Reddit. Yeah, you can see that it's supposed to be paired with a glider. So I don't know what villain for Spider-Man has a glider on him. And the other thing is, in the secret lab that Norman has, you see grenades, purple grenades, that very easily could look like pumpkin bombs, but I could be wrong. So there was... Pardon?
You're essentially just telling me Willem Dafoe might show up in the next Spider-Man game.
He could.
Loki kind of looks like Willem Dafoe, but not quite. Like a better looking version of Willem Dafoe.
Well, in my opinion, Willem Dafoe nailed the Green Goblin, so.
Of course he did.
Yeah, it's Willem Dafoe.
Listen, really quickly.
He is the Green Goblin.
People give shit to the Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy. It's actually not that bad. Like, it's actually a really good series.
The first two are very strong. I can see issues with the third one from the casting from Venom, just the bloated story and everything along those lines.
I wouldn't say the casting. I think Topher Grace did a pretty decent job as Eddie Brock. I mean, he was as tough and scary as Eddie Brock should be. However, he did a pretty decent job, and that wasn't his fault.
Yeah, there was a lot. I think that ultimately rests on Sony. Should
have been in that movie, but that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, that rests on Sony. But I thought the first two did an amazing job, and you can see little nods to that the Sam Raimi universe in this game.
Oh, absolutely.
At one point, Peter tries to stop a train, and he tries to stop it like he did in Spider-Man 2 with Doc Ock, and it doesn't work. And he's like, "Oh, that worked before." I was like, I know that reference. I like that reference. I think with the build, with that post-credit scene, I think that sets you up for at least two games. And one of the points, Jesse, in the final boss fight is Doc Ock stabs Peter in the shoulder with one of his tentacles. And instead of kind of trying to wiggle free of anything, the best way to defeat Doc Ock and the quickest way to defeat Doc Ock was to let him stab him even more, make the wound worse, and then defeat Doc Ock. So this is a Peter Parker that's willing to sacrifice his health and well-being to save the people around him, and that's what happened in the Ultimate Universe. That's ultimately what led us to Miles, was Peter died making the ultimate sacrifice against the Green Goblin. And just with how the pieces are moving, I'm positive that they're going to have a different story and things are going to be different, but it seems like they've got the parts that this Spider-Man will be willing to make the ultimate sacrifice, and that will lead to, I believe, eventually Miles having his own game completely, as long as sales do well and the games continue to be made the way they are.
Well, I mean, if there was ever a Spider-Man I like the most... As a kid, I had a bunch of Spider-Man 2099 comics.
Oh, I love Spider-Man 2099. People hated it, but I loved it.
You can play with that costume. There was a bunch of costumes here that you could choose from for Spidey, and one of them was Spidey 2099.
Well, there was a Spider-Man game that came out a while back that had, like, Spider-Man Noir.
Shattered Dimensions. I loved
that game. Yeah, wasn't Spider-Man 2099 in that?
Yes, he was.
See, I kind of like that version, that futuristic kind of looking
Spider-Man, me personally. Like, nothing against the other ones, it just Spider-Man 2099 was the one I kind of liked as a kid.
Yeah, no, and so, that is the one thing about the multiverse that I do like, is there's a variety of Spideys.
Well, yeah, like, you guys like this Spider-Man game because you guys are really hardcore Spider-Man fans.
Well, okay.
I don't think I would enjoy this game as much because of that.
Oh, no, you wouldn't.
Because, like, unless it was a strictly Spider-Man 2099 game.
So, with Spider-Man 2099 in general, you can actually, like Joel said, you unlock the costume, and you can just play as Spider-Man 2099, essentially.
Yeah, even but, like, though, in the comics, the way technology and the city skyline looks is so drastically different.
Oh, I agree. But here's the other thing, too, though. This could open up games to different Spider-Man. Like, it's not going to be just strictly Peter Parker. Like, we don't know what they could do. Because I don't know if you heard or saw, but they were saying that this Spider-Man game could be the next Iron Man of Marvel video games. Because you know how Iron Man was the very first Marvel movie that set off the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe, right?
Well, I would beg to differ. I think Ang Lee's The Hulk was the one that set off. Trolling right now, by the way.
I know you are. I just was trying to think of what I wanted to say to that, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to let Jesse have it.
I thought I heard Joel stutter a bit, and I was like, gosh, shit, I better tell him I'm trolling because he might think I'm telling the truth.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's canon now, that's what you believe, Jesse. So I'm going to hold that over you for the rest of your life. So.
Nick Nolte is the absorbing man.
Oh boy. Yep.
Anyways.
You know, I just want to say it took about 42 minutes for this to potentially go off the rails. I think that's the longest time we've had a conversation that it's taken that long to almost go off the rails. It's not quite off the rails, but it could get there.
Well, we stuck to Spider-Man, which was the important part.
And
yeah.
And we got to talk about all. Is there anything we're missing from that? Enjoyed the combat.
No, I mean, okay. Overall, Spider-Man as the game was amazing. Like, story-wise, it was fantastic from start to finish. There were a couple weak points in the story, but it is what it is. Not every game can be perfect, but the storyline was actually really well done. It was very well written. The boss fights were awesome. I loved every single boss fight we did that was in there. There was a lot of notable moments, like, for example, when you are stung by Scorpion and his venom and you have that hallucinogenic trip as that one mission. That was awesome. All the boss fights against Mr. Negative were really good. The final one, though, was probably the best.
Yeah.
The boss fight against Dr. Octopus was awesome. I loved that fight so much. The boss fights against Electro, Vulture, and even the Rhino and Scorpion were very underwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't as exciting as the rest of them were to be. And, like, it was kind of not disappointing, but it felt like they didn't have substantial things to happen for the fight. So they were very, like, similar, and you kind of just, you put them down, you put them, Rhino in a crate, you trap up Scorpion, that's it. You tie up Electro, and you tie up Vulture, and that's it.
Yeah.
The side mission where you do the whole Tombstone storyline.
Yes.
And the boss fight against Tombstone, amazing.
I love
significantly, that. That one stood out to me as one of the most, like, of the better boss fights. That's in my top three for boss fights.
I loved having just the storyline with Tombstone and having him be a biker gang.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. And that's what I mean. So, like, when it comes to boss fights, there was a lot of good boss fights, but there was also some weak boss fights. And it is what it is. But overall, the game was really well done, and it definitely took Spider-Man in a new direction. But not just Spider-Man alone, but, like, superhero video games in general.
This could be the launching point.
Exactly, of, like, a whole slew of really well-done superhero video games, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you've got the hint of Avengers Tower, so really and truly, the next Spidey could... You don't know what's going to happen next.
Exactly, and, like, there's so much that they can do with this game, and that's why I think it's very successful. And even just chasing after all the trophies were really cool to get too, and you felt like you accomplished something.
Yeah.
Even though the completing the 100% in every district was a grind and very long, and that's what took me the longest out of all the trophies to get.
Yeah.
I still had an overall good time. Like when I played the game, when I was playing the game, for the very first part of the game, I wasn't even focused on the main story. I was doing all the side quests.
Yeah.
And everything first. And then I started doing the story, and I was like, oh my god, this story is so good.
I felt that they paced it out very well, because it was very side mission heavy to start. Like, there wasn't a whole lot for you to do at the beginning. You had a couple of the missions, and you could get the story going. But I felt like you could easily spend more time on the side missions. And once the bulk of those done, the story started to ramp up. And as the story started to ramp up, you had less to do around districts. So it became a point where you're like, well, I'm just going to keep going at this story because this is really good. And it wasn't until after the raft when you're like, oh, I got to go do a bunch of these side missions. And then once you finish that, then you can top the story off with a fantastic boss fight.
Oh, absolutely. And I thought that was really cool and really well done. So, like, overall, the game was really, really well done. But, like, there were some parts that kind of lacked, but it's not a big deal because the game overall was really fantastic, and I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah,
like, I played for, a couple of days straight.
Oh, it's so easy to get sucked into that universe. Just swinging around the city was incredible.
And not just, like, swinging through the city, but it also was very engaging with down below, too. Like, you could go through the streets of New York, and you could say hi to people, and some people would give you little mini side quests to do, which I thought was very clever.
Yeah, it definitely added to the story. Just the interactiveness and just the look of New York as a whole was gorgeous.
Oh, it was beautiful. Good job.
Jesse, I know that you have an Xbox, and we don't hold it against you too much.
I have an Xbox too, so.
Well, we don't hold that against you too much either.
But I got an Xbox for Cuphead.
Yeah, it's.
Which is one of the best reasons to buy an Xbox, in my opinion.
Jesse, does this, hearing anything about Spidey, I know this is a PlayStation exclusive, but does this pique your interest at all in a game like this? Do you. If more Marvel games started to come to just the PlayStation, would you consider getting one? Like, I'm just kind of getting your mindset as someone that hasn't played it, and you do have a console system that you can't play Spidey on it.
No, not really. I'm not a superhero video. Everybody went off on how cool. Not my type of games. I don't like superhero games.
No? Hey, no, and that's what totally about fair.
Jesse's favorite superhero game, though, and, like, I'm not gonna lie, it is a great game, is Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
I never finished that game. I enjoyed bits of it. But if you actually do want to know my favorite superhero game, you're gonna get mad at me.
Probably not. Is it Spider-Man 3? Because no, I actually... enjoy that.
No, it's the one that was based off Ang Lee's The Hulk.
They had a video game for that?
I was just going to say
an original, not an Xbox 360, but an original Xbox.
Was it just on the Xbox?
It was on computer, Xbox, and it could have been on PlayStation, I think.
Sorry, what was it? The Hulk video game?
It's just called Hulk.
And it'd be 2003, because that's when Ang Lee's Hulk came out.
Oh my god, I do remember this game. Okay.
I played that game till the end. I loved that game. Yeah,
but, okay, let me just say something here. That game did really well, though. A lot of people actually gave it a good rating. So, I mean, it was a good game.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I remember, as a kid, I kind of thought the Hulk movie was really cool, the one with Eric Bana. But... when that game came out, I loved the game even more.
Yeah, it was
just
better.
Just because it was so much more of a comic book movie.
Yeah.
Or it did scenes in there better than I liked it in Hulk. And, like, I know I just said I don't like comic book video games, but it's because for me, it's always comics should be one directional, right? When you give them to PG. I don't feel like, oh, well, you're kind of making your own story now. And for some reason, that kind of
drives me away. I don't know why. If there was a play as a comic book game, I'd like it to be very linear and one-sided, not an open-world game. And Hulk wasn't that. It was various levels that you went through and, you know... Like, yeah, just... I can explain it. It was a very linear experience, and I liked it because it was like reading a book, like reading a comic book.
Yeah, that's fair.
Hey, I mean...
And also, too, you're not being biased or anything, but Hulk is one of your favorite Marvel comic heroes.
Yes.
So it kind of works out for Jesse. No, I mean, everyone's going to have a different flavor that they enjoy. Like, for me, I enjoy Spider-Man, and I enjoyed what I got from this game, but I mean, there's other people that are going to be like, eh, this wasn't quite for me. And there's going to be other people that are going to be like, this is my jam, this is what I want to play, and that's totally fine. As long as you enjoy yourself and not beating people to death with a controller, then you're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yep. that's our take on Spider-Man, but we're not going to shut up at that. There's still more to talk about. Jesse, you had something you wanted to talk about. You've been pretty quiet about with Spider-Man, so what'd you want to talk about, buddy?
Well, I'm kind of excited. There's two games that are coming out next year. One of them is a re-release of an old game that I used to play as a kid with my cousins. And the other one is a new game coming out by a really good developer. So to start things off, Onimusha Warlords is getting a remaster and re-release on our Xbox One and PS4. Now, Onimusha Warlords is a Capcom game I can best describe as Resident Evil in feudal Japan.
Yeah, that's pretty much correct, I would say.
So you play a young warrior tasked with... again, I've never beat the game. I've only played it when I was at my cousin's house. And half the time we were too scared to play it because it was just a... You only have a sword and you're going up against, you know, these zombie, demon-possessed... creatures, as far as I can remember. But it wasn't so much that type of gameplay I loved, but the aesthetics of it. I loved the way the backgrounds looked. I liked the way the characters looked. I liked the way the gameplay kind of broke it down. It was very similar to Resident Evil. Like the first two games where the camera was in a fixed position and you would walk around until you got to the next area, and the camera angle would change and the scenery would change as well. What I really liked about it was the way it looked, and it kind of, I think from a young age, sparked my interest in the way to me feudal Japan and just the, like, if you look at the old Japanese art, which I love, the way they do scenery and stuff like that, that game is essentially what sparked my interest in it. And then the second game that's coming out is from Software, the same creators of Dark Souls and Bloodborne, is called Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice, and it's again a game that has very feudal Japan like aspects to it that I find very interesting. So I'm excited for those two games.
I'm super excited for Shadows Die Twice, mainly because, like, first off, I absolutely love the whole Dark Souls Bloodborne series. Like, Dark Souls to me is one of the greatest things to exist. And I love that From Software is not necessarily moving on from Dark Souls, but they are in a way where they're creating a new world with new characters. And I'm really happy that they chose to go and do something in, like you would say, feudal Japan. And I think that's a brilliant idea. And, like, the storyline and everything we've seen so far in all the trailers just makes this game look very gorgeous. And I do agree, Japanese art in general is just so beautiful. And it is very intriguing.
Like, with me, one of my favorite forms of media is Japanese horror. I love it. And again, Onimusha sparked that in me because the Japanese have their own individual uniqueness when it comes to not only just tales of the supernatural, but they're horror. And any Japanese horror I can get my hands on, I'll pretty much immediately fall in love with it. And I don't know why. It's just
the way the stories and characters are portrayed. But if you were to throw together Japanese horror in a feudal Japan setting, I'm in heaven. And that's why I loved Onimusha so much, is it kind of hit those two high notes for me. So Sekiro, while I don't think it's so much as Japanese horror, it does have that feeling to it. I can't explain it. I just like the way the environment looks.
Oh, it's absolutely.
Just something I always, if I was ever to go to Japan, I would stay out of the cities and go to the small villages and Shinto shrines, because those are where the real beautiful, well, at least my point of view, the more beautiful looking aesthetics of Japanese culture comes through, is they make these beautiful shrines, and the way they have the signature shingled roofs and whatnot. It's just such a beautiful, for me, it's just gorgeous architecture and a beautiful environment that the Japanese have that I absolutely love.
Oh, I agree. And the other thing too, with Shadows Die Twice, based off From Software alone, their boss fights are just amazing, and they know how to make really good one-player storyline and boss battles, and like, I'm excited for that, and I'm excited for the difficulty of the game.
Like, it did spur another feeling in me. There was a movie, and I'm pretty sure most people have heard of it. It's called Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah.
So Akira Kurosawa is the guy that kind of influenced George Lucas through his movies, you know, with movies like Hidden Fortress and Ron and whatnot. Sekiro has got that pleasing kind of nostalgia about it, at least from what I've seen through some of the source and trailers, that I think they can hit a really big audience with this. Because sometimes samurai, like, oh, the typical samurai genre has been overdone quite a bit. But a lot of it is misconception. And I think we've seen that misconception with other kind of warrior games that have come out and stuff like that. Like, take For Honor, for example. You know, Vikings, Knights, and Samurai. This game is going to kind of, at least I hope it does, portray the real samurai. Because most people think of them as just, you know, these sword-bound warriors and stuff like that. Well, they're not. They're very complex and very, very detailed warrior case that wasn't just so much going around and acting all tough and whatnot, but actually very integral to feudal Japan's political system and economic system, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were a class of nobility also, in a sense. Kind of like the way medieval knights were, I would imagine. But
right.
I'm just kind of tired of the whole hack and slash kind of, you know, essence that's been propagated by a lot of Western bias. You know, I really want to just see, like, the warrior poet kind of samurai, not right. so much and the overdone anime 500,000 Omniblade slash type of samurai that you usually see,
I mean, nothing against Neo, but that's kind of how that game, in my opinion, was I never really played Neo. I just saw lots of gameplay and trailers, and I did contemplate playing it once upon a time, but then I kind of was just, I didn't have an interest in it. Whereas this game, From Software looks to be, like, they know what they're doing when it comes to story. Like, there's a lot of things that they don't tell you in the main story, but they also have a lot of things where they want you to explore the environment. They want you to explore the things that you collect and the items that you have and read the description. Because if you read the description of a lot of stuff, like, for example, from Dark Souls and even Bloodborne, it gives you a lot of lore and backstory of what's going on in the environment around you. And I think that's going to be one of the things that From Software does really well, especially with this game, where not everything's going to be on the surface, but for those who really care, like, for example, you, by really digging deep into the backstory of everything in the game, and the environments are going to be really well done.
Yeah, anytime I see cherry blossoms and stuff like that, where they're starting to drop their petals,
the first like visage that comes to mind, the first thought is Japan, because that's like I think everybody kind of associates Japan with the cherry blossom, I would assume.
Yeah.
It's just such a, for them, it's also a very culturally important plant. But no, that, like, I don't know. It's just, I have a hard time conveying my feeling because it's, it takes me back a bit. Like, when I first saw, I don't know, I think it was just a teaser. You just see kind of a, like, shady light of some sort of mechanical device. I went, oh, I wonder what this will be. And when it was revealed at the E3 conference, I was like, boom, I'm in love right away.
Oh, absolutely. Because, which is funny that you say that, because a lot of people actually believed and thought that that was going to be Bloodborne 2. Which is really funny, because if you look at it again and you watch that little teaser and compare it to now, it's the dude's arm being punched.
Yeah, he's got a cool mechanical device added to it.
Yeah, and I thought that was really clever of them.
Yeah, no, like, they, I'm just, I can't explain how, or explain why I'm just so excited for it. I just have this balled up feeling in me that just can't wait to get it.
Oh, I know, I'm actually pretty excited about it too.
But, and it was kind of a dual hit for me as well, because after I kind of got into, like, okay, I'm looking up some stuff about Sekiro Shadows Die Twice, and then it was announced that Onimusha Warlords was being upgraded and re-released on our newer consoles, it was kind of like that was the nail in the coffin that got me so stoked for next year. It's literally just those two games, pretty much.
Yeah, I agree.
And I really hope that Sekiro and even maybe Onimusha can kind of refresh the whole samurai genre when it comes to games.
Well, okay, so with Onimusha, for example, it's essentially just a remaster, if I recall, of the original one.
Yeah, like Onimusha Warlords was the very first game that came out on PlayStation 2, if I think. And they're just taking it and making all the graphics better and then re-releasing it for Xbox One and PS4.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's still going to be pretty much the same game as you remember, but there are going to be a couple graphic improvements and flow of the game, control mechanics, and just little things like that.
Yeah. What I want to do is I want people to start playing these games and kind of get the market aware that these games are out there and people are playing them. I think a lot of people will enjoy both Sekiro and Onimusha if they haven't played them before.
Absolutely, I agree.
If not just for gameplay, but just how aesthetically pleasing they are on the eye.
Yeah.
Because I remember when Resident Evil was remastered for the GameCube, I played the first one with my cousin, one of my cousins. I have a bunch of cousins, by the way, so I'm not always talking about the same one. We rented the very first Resident Evil for the PlayStation, and even the choppy graphics with it, my cousin went around the corner and that one zombie that eats the STARS member, Kenneth, pulls up and looks at him, freaked me out so horribly, and added commentary of my cousin saying, "Oh my god, it's eating his face!" Made me bolt up to the stairs in tears. Now, fast forward a good couple of years, I'm not an adult yet, but I'm a kid still. I'm an older kid. Resident Evil gets a complete remaster on the GameCube, and I pick it up, and I said, "Oh man, I can't wait to finally sit down and beat this game. I'm not scared of it anymore." Well, guess what, my friends? I popped in the disc and I started it out, and within, I think, the first couple minutes, and again, I get to the same part that freaked me out as a kid, and with those graphics, it's an even more of a shock to me that I remember turning the GameCube off and having a nightmare that night. So, and I could not play that game for at least another 5 years. I'm not kidding, it scared me that much.
So, just to establish, I don't think you've ever become an adult. I think you just, I just want to make sure that that's well known.
For legal
that you
purposes, yes, oh I'm an God. Adult. Mentally, no.
I was like expecting something totally different, but also I'm not surprised that you even chose to go there.
It was low hanging fruit, so I gotta go for it. But it, it's one of those things where, like, I know you like horror and you like being scared. And to
me, love being scared. I don't know why. And I don't mean scared as in the sense I want to walk, you know, down a back alley one night and have a guy pull a knife or a gun on me. Not that type of scared. Scared for my soul, if that makes any sense.
It's just a sense of, like, thrill and suspense and, like, oh my god, it's the unexpected. That's what it is.
I think Jesse's an like adrenaline dread. Junkie.
Probably. Almost
dread. No, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I just said I don't want to go, like, walking around a horrible neighborhood or a back alley and potentially get robbed or stabbed or something like that. No, I care about my own self-preservation of my body, but what I want to experience is a dread for my soul, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, no, and like there's a number of movies and video games that will scare you to your core of your soul. So I mean that's and that's the thing, like you talk about, I'm not a fan of horror. I'm a chicken. I think that's very well established among the three of us that I am a chicken. I do not like horror movies. What movie did we do? I think we went to go see Mama,
which isn't a horror movie, but yeah, we did.
I still at the beginning I was like, oh, this is a horror movie, so I'm just going to keep my hat by my face and kind of inch it up every once in a while. Ultimately, it wasn't scary, but the preference is, oh, this kind of freaks me out. Like, even seeing you guys have seen the trailers for the newest Halloween that's coming out very soon.
Oh, I'm absolutely. Like, of course I have.
Yeah,
I'm interested in that. I think that's the first horror movie I'm like, I think this would be just a really good movie overall. But there are different points in the trailer where I've seen stuff like him dropping the teeth and the him popping up at random points. I'm like, I would probably jump out of the movie theater a couple dozen times, but it's a movie that I'm interested in, but it still scared me.
For me, like, jump scares are kind of a cheap tactic to get somebody to be, oh yeah, you're scared. In my opinion, pardon me, I just belched there. In my opinion, the best jump scares happen with no surprise. It's you create the jump scare for yourself. It's like a...
Absolutely correct, Jesse.
A sinister realization of something, or you scare yourself into it. Those are the best jump scares.
It's those thriller, like I would look at it as more of like a thriller of that tension building towards a moment. You know something's coming. You might not quite know what it is, but you know that there's something deep in your, like you said, your soul. You know something's coming, and you don't want it to happen, but it's just the train's moving along, and it's not stopping, and it's still going, and you're just, like, it freaks you out. And the other aspect of that is that it goes back to the movie, like, Jaws, where it's, you don't have to always see what happens, but it'll still freak you out, because your imagination is going to suddenly play out all these different little scenarios, and they're going to be more terrifying than what they would show you on screen.
And that comes back full circle to what I was talking about with Japanese horror. Japanese horror is not jump scary. It's the slow, sinister, existential dread that fills you watching these movies. They use movement and makeup and whatnot to get some truly grotesque and just sinister, you know, characters and looks out of things. But it's very rarely have I ever seen jump scares in a Japanese horror. It's always been the slow onslaught of your soul being taken away from you slowly. And the best way I can point this out is the comparisons between the movie Ringu and The Ring. The Ring is the American remake of Ringu.
And it's the same as, for example, Ju-on and The Grudge. Ju-on is significantly better, in my opinion.
Yeah. See, I love Ju-on. I watched The Grudge as a kid, and it scared me. But when I watched Ju-on,
I was
terrified. I was like, holy shit. And the same thing again with Ringu and The Ring. When I watched The Ring, I was jump scared all the time, right? It was a jolt of fear. When I watched Ringu, it was just like a sickening fear that came over me, especially when Samara crawls out of the well.
Yep,
They did that good in The Ring, the American remake. They nailed that part, I think. They didn't use any jump scares with her. It was just the slow, you know, approach of this rotten, demon-like girl just making her way towards the screen and into your world. And I think, you know, in both cases, those are what fill me with dread. And for some reason, I love it.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely, it is something that is very realistic, where unfortunately with North American horror for the most part, it's just not as well done as the Japanese, where they use those elements to scare you instead of jump scares.
Japanese horror, American horror, it hurts you, but you're over the pain pretty quickly. It's like a bee sting, whereas Japanese horror is like being burned. It sticks with you for a long time, and every now and again you can feel it within your, you know, you can feel it on you again at some time, even though it's long since passed.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And I don't know, there's different Japanese movies that I know. Some of them aren't necessarily even horror, they're just Japanese thriller, but they follow the same archetype that I'll even remember from day to day, like, oh my god, like, it just pops back up into my mind again. You know, a scene from a movie that they played out so well, but no, I really hope that it's these, especially Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice, that really, really refresh the market, and then allow more video games and media based upon Japanese culture in general can be properly made, because there's just such a wealth of, it's such a treasure of lore that Japanese have that can be made into some really beautiful things, I think.
Well, it's, oh, yeah. It's
for sure.
It's interesting because you talk about this, and it's interesting just how the Japanese culture, it feels like it's starting to make a little bit of a, I guess you'd say, resurgence in the states, North America side. And I mean, the one thing that my mind instantly goes to is Japanese pro wrestling is becoming very popular stateside, and that the style and the form and the way they tell stories in the ring and the way the characters are portrayed and the attention to detail that these guys have, like, New Japan Pro Wrestling has been absolutely killing it on the wrestling scene. And it's just, it's fascinating because it might not be the same, but you're finding more and more that Japanese storytelling is very, very, very good. And it's very, it translates to North America. It might not be the same language, but the story still translates. And you can still grab that story and be scared and enthralled and interested in this tale that they're telling. And I think I absolutely agree with you. I hope we see more Japanese culture and Japanese storytelling pop up stateside.
It's just such a well done form of media, in my opinion. I'd like to see more of it and a lot more people get exposed to it.
Oh yeah, no,
because a lot of my friends and whatnot don't really know too much. Like, a couple of them do, but not a lot of them have ideas about or an understanding of Japanese horror in general. And I want that to change, because these are really cool, really interesting stories and tales that, like, I think people could apply in day to day use, right?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree.
No, I wish there was a lot more storytelling done in the Japanese way, which is all about quality over quantity.
Yeah.
I want more of that because, in my opinion, the media we currently have today is stagnating.
No, that's a fair point. And I think this is a very fascinating and interesting conversation, and I think that there's a lot of different things within this within storytelling that I think you're absolutely right. You've hit the nail on the head with this. But with time and time constraints, I think we're gonna have to shimmy on away from this topic. You've covered it very well, Jesse. I didn't think you'd cover it as well as you did, but you had so much information and detail that it was kind of like, oh, well, we'll just kind of let Jesse continue to talk, and we got a lot. But there's a few other things I want to hit before we go, and one of the things is you had a question for us at the beginning, Anthony. What's your question?
I do. So we don't have to talk about it for very long. It's just a quick question. Do you guys feel that with video games and how they have been for the past couple of years, do you feel that these loot crates and stuff like that are taking away from gaming experience?
Yep. I don't like them. I'm not a fan of them. I used to get NHL every year, and just with they are with EA, and we generally know how people feel about EA Sports. I find one thing, I see those loot crates, and I was just like, I just don't have any time, because this is going to be all-consuming. This is an extra cost that I just don't want to pay. I don't have any interest in. I mean, there's a game like Fortnite that has, I guess you'd call them loot crate likes, where you can get other skins and different stuff like that. But I have no interest in it, and I just think, as a whole, it's something that should be, you should limit. You're never going to get rid of it fully, but I think you should limit how impactful it is to a game and how intricate it is to completing the game. I feel like that should be, if you want to spend some money, you can, but you don't have to.
Right. There are loot crates that do allude to, like you said, Fortnite. Overwatch is another one, where if you get these loot crates, it's just new skins and emotes and different things like that for the character. So it's just customization. It actually has none, or it doesn't play a factor into progression in the game. Where there are some games, though, where loot crates do play a big value. Star Wars Battlefront 2 was a big example. However, they did get rid of them to an extent, I believe it is, because players were easily able to, you know, get good, as Jesse would say, without actually being good.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing. I think certain aspects of gaming should be very much about your skill. And when you strip it down to, oh, I've got 20 extra dollars, so I'm going to be... Like, if the three of us were playing a game, and I'm the worst gamer out of the three of us, and I probably am, and I can spend 20 extra dollars, and then I can easily kill both you and Jesse in the game, then it's a little bit like, well, what's the challenge in that? I just spent $20 to buy a win. That's no fun. I'd much rather beat you on my skill and my my ability to do it than spending money. So yeah, I'm not a fan of that.
What about you, Jesse? Loot crates started off as a way for mobile games to make money. These were usually dinky little, you know, games that like Clash of Clans, or, you know what I mean, these just mobile games that had, I'm not saying there was no effort put into them, but to compare them with like a game that had a huge team working on it of devs and like has a $80 sale to it, what reason and what, like, what thought processes are you going through where you think that, hey, you know what, those mobile games had a thing, we can make extra money by making loot crates off of them? You change the aesthetics of a game by doing that. Instead of Star Wars Battlefront 2, when those loot crate things were announced, I literally just saw, like, some, like, iPad game. That's what it kind of felt to me for a while, like. It felt like I was playing like a mobile game. It didn't feel like a console game anymore. It's just having them in general, even if they're for aesthetics, like, just feels weird to me. I don't like it. It's stupid.
I'm still a big fan of everything in game. Like, there's certain DLC I'm willing to get. Like, for example, I got WWE 2K19. And there are certain people not in the game, but will be in DLC. And I'm not sure how it works behind the scenes, or if it was because they came into WWE later. But it was just one of those things where it's like, you probably could have got them in the game to start. But I feel like you want my $10. just for
they absolutely do want your $10. It's not whether or not, obviously, they could probably get the characters in from the start, but it also could be they were developing these characters but weren't quite ready for the initial release but didn't want to postpone it, and because DLC is so popular, and I feel DLC became really big because of Call of Duty, in my opinion, everybody's like, oh, yeah, we'll just spend that extra $10 or that extra $20.
Yeah.
Spend it's... $25 or $30, and then you get the season pass.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing now where really and truly a game's $80, but you can spend up to $110, $120 for the season pass, and then you're like, oh, well, I've got everything. And then you have the complete game for $120, and that's a little crazy to me.
With DLC, I'm fine with it, but there was a tactic used by a couple of video game companies where they would have the content already on the disc and then lock it out, and you would have to, the DLC was essentially a code to unlock it on the disc.
Hmm. Yep.
See, when you do stupid shit like that, you really alienate your fan base here, because you find a new tactic to make money. Okay, well, I'm selling you a cake. Okay, I have all the icing, I've made it all finished. But you're not allowed to eat the berries that I've put on it unless you pay me an additional $10. That's what it felt like. That's what when they do lockout codes like that, that's what it feels like. No, I bought the fucking cake. I get to eat whatever part of it I want. You know what I mean?
No, we definitely hit.
No, Jesse, I get what you're saying.
No, it makes sense because it is that. Essentially, you bought something, but hey, you don't get this part because
you need to pay more. Here, let me just take the berries off of your cake here because you didn't pay me an extra $10. No, I bought the cake for $80 right here now as it is. You don't get to take the berries off and then say fork over another $10. You don't get to do that. No, the final product that is made and put on that disc is the final product. I'm sorry if anybody disagrees, but that's the truth.
No, I agree with you. That's why I like DLC to me is a joke sometimes. Yeah. One of the biggest jokes for the DLC, for example, an example of DLC being a big joke is you spend $80 on Star Wars Battlefront, like the first Battlefront that they did, right? And then the season pass was like $65 or
what?
Something like that. It was either $60 or $65. And you're like, that's why I couldn't justify ever getting the season pass
for
Battlefront. Because it's like, you're paying for, what was it? What did they give you? 3 extra levels and like 2 characters or 1 character in each pack?
Something like that. I can't remember. But I bought them individually for about $10 each, I think.
Exactly. It was a complete joke, in my opinion. The pricing for it was so bad, I couldn't comprehend it.
I look at it as with DLC, I think certain aspects like that is a ripoff. That is not good. But I look at certain other DLC, if it adds or improves the game or extends its shelf life a little bit longer. Like, for example, I've got the Spider-Man DLC. So when that comes out, I'll be playing that. It's one of those things where you sit there and you're like, okay, I'm willing to pay for this because I'm going to get more stories. I enjoyed the game. But it didn't impact how I felt about the end of the game, because I got to the end of the game, I unlocked everything that I wanted to unlock in game, and this is just an added bonus for it. I think that's acceptable, but I don't think what's acceptable is when it ties into either it's a crazy price, like $60. It's pretty much what video games used to cost, and then having like rinky-dink things like that. $60 should get you basically a whole new game. It shouldn't get you, oh, here's a couple new levels and here's a new skin pack. Woo! No,
it shouldn't even be $60. They should just give it to you for free and give you the full game, because if we talk about Star Wars Battlefront, the first one, that game was a joke in my opinion. Sure, they fixed it in Battlefront 2, but still, the first one was a big joke.
It was only Empire versus Rebels. I had fun with the game. A lot of times I was playing with a friend of mine, but it wasn't the Battlefront 1 and 2 for the original Xbox. that I had. You know what I mean? That was a fun game.
Because that game had context, and you could play it and enjoy yourself. And there was way more details. And that's the other thing, too, is if we were to compare games back then and games now, games back then were a lot better. But that's personal preference.
Yeah, I agree with you, though. But if you want to talk about good DLC, look at Morrowind. When Elder Scrolls 3 Morrowind came out, they had that huge game.
Jesse.
And then when the expansions came out, like Blood Moon for one, or Tribunal, it just added on to the life of the game, which is what it's supposed to do. You don't sell a season pass for $60, and then, as Joel said, here's a couple of levels and a couple of skins or something like that. No, fuck off.
Okay, I agree with you, but you can't compare Morrowind to something that's now, because Morrowind is an older game. Morrowind is exactly what I just said, that older games back then were better than what they are now. Because even though some older games had DLC, sure, but the DLC made sense.
There's a meme that went around a while back, and it was like, games back then, and it showed a hamburger, and you bought the hamburger, and the french fries and drink were DLC. And then it said games now, and it showed hamburger buns as the game, the meat, the cheese, are DLC.
Yep.
The condiments are GameStop and EB Games exclusives. That's exactly how I feel now.
You just want your burger, fries, and drink.
Just give me my fucking food.
No, I don't disagree with you at all. I want what I paid for, and I don't want to have to pay more to get what I should get in a game. It's now become, it's basically that paper cut to death. And I don't know. I like getting my games and having them pretty much whole. If I want some DLC, then I can get some DLC, but I want to be able to just play my game and not have to spend any more money. Just tune out and play games.
Yeah, no, I agree.
That's DLC, and that's kind of it for video games, but before we get out of here, there is one last question I had for you guys, and just get your take on something that's not video game related, and we both have different is the Aladdin movie. The teaser trailer got dropped, and I don't know about you guys, but the original Aladdin was a very big part of my childhood.
Yeah.
Jesse, you haven't seen the trailer. Why haven't you not seen the trailer?
I don't want to watch trailers for movies, and not so much even games really anymore, because I feel it takes away from some of the magic.
Yeah, that seems to be a growing trend.
Even though I know what happens in Aladdin, I'd rather going in not knowing how people sound or what it looks like, just so that I can experience it again I go see it at the theater.
I mean, so for me, I, unfortunately, as a personal preference and personal opinion, I don't have high expectations for live-action movies based off Disney movies specifically.
Yeah.
In my opinion, all the live-action ones actually kind of sucked. I wasn't a big fan of them. Like, I watched the Tarzan one, the Jungle Book one, and Tarzan 2. Tarzan 1 sucked. The Jungle Book one was okay. Like, I wasn't super into it. I never watched the Cinderella one. I love Cinderella, but I didn't watch the live action. The Beauty and the Beast one, though, did surprise me. I actually really enjoyed that. The one with Emma Watson. I thought that was pretty well done, actually. So maybe there is hope for this one. The only thing that, like, excites me about this Aladdin is that Will Smith is the genie.
My thing with this movie is it's going to be really hard to see the big blue genie pop up and not hear Robin Williams' voice. That's going to be the toughest part. I don't know how Will Smith's going to do, and I don't want to jump on any bandwagon whether it'll be good or bad. It'll really depend on the movie as a whole and what happens within it. But just heading into it, I know it's a non-factor, but it's going to be very weird not hearing Robin Williams.
Okay, you could say that, but you could also say that about every previous Disney movie, though.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
I don't know, though. Every
single live-action movie is always recast. And it is very similar. Like, for example, you have a very strong connection to Aladdin, right?
Yeah.
I don't. Like, I think Aladdin is great. I really like it. But when I see this one, if I go and watch it, I'm not going to be thinking about Robin Williams as Genie because, to me, that didn't matter.
Yeah.
So it's all to everybody. Like, for everybody, it's different. Like, each person as a kid had a different attachment. Like, for me, my biggest attachment was Little Mermaid and The Lion King.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are redoing The Lion King. So it's going to be different for me, too.
Yeah.
When I go watch. But I'm still going to go watch it, most likely. But the thing is like I said, I have no faith in live-action Disney movies.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And, I mean, it goes back to, like, as we've talked through this whole thing, it's really subjective on how you feel about certain things, whether you like it or you don't. It's really up to you and how you feel. I'm a little bit more hesitant, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up was... within the trailer, they had recited the poem from the cave of wonders. They had that poem that had been said, "Only worthy shall enter," and there was an uproar online because the original screenwriters, the people that wrote that poem for the original Aladdin, aren't being compensated for their work, and basically. Disney has taken their work from the original Aladdin, and it sounds like they more or less are using pretty much verbatim for this movie. We'll have to wait and see for that movie. If this is true, should the writers from the original Aladdin be compensated for this new live-action Aladdin?
I mean, okay. How many people who create things and have things redone or re-envisioned or... whether it's movies, books, or video games or whatever, how often do those people actually get credit for it?
Not often.
Okay. Obviously, the right thing to do is, yes, give them credit, but realistically, is that what's going to happen?
No, God, probably. No.
Unfortunately.
Disney... I mean, that's the thing. Like, Disney's a big corporation. If they're going to... They've obviously a smart corporation because of how much money they've made. They're not going to dole out money willy-nilly and be like, oh, yeah, no, good faith, here's some money. But I just saw a lot of... There were some upset people because they weren't being compensated for their work.
And I mean, it is what it is, unfortunately. It is hard to say if they're going to get compensated or not. Maybe Disney will.
Yeah.
Maybe it won't, but I mean, it is unfortunate, especially for those who create things. But sadly, in a world where we live in, not everyone gets credit for what they create.
No. Jesse, any thoughts?
On the poem, like...
Yeah, on the writers not being compensated, like the original screenwriters for Aladdin. And potentially if they...
Really,
they use...
I don't really have an opinion because... I don't know the legality of it all.
Yeah.
Like fair use and stuff like that. I'm not well vested in that. I think they should be, if they're the ones that made it, I think they should be given credit, obviously. But again, I can't sit here and pretend to know like what's right and what's wrong in terms with something like this when it comes to copyright claim. If it were me, I would like, you know, to be compensated for essentially my works being used, but it's all in the fine print, right?
Yeah, yep. and that's reality. And that's the way things work. I just wanted to get your perspective because there's always no story is cut and dry. There are certain stories that are very cut and dry, but for more times than not, there's a very big gray area, and there's different ways to look at things. Everyone has, like, your points on legality is great, because we don't know what contract those writers signed with Disney, and if there is something where it's like, well, if we reuse your stuff, then it's, you've done it, why pay you a second time for a job we've already paid you for? That
exactly.
That could be a mindset with this. So, I was just kind of curious on just the different perspectives on it.
In my opinion, the right thing to do would be to obviously pay them, because they essentially created it, therefore they should have some sort of patent right. But if they signed a contract stating you're paid for it only this once, then you know what I mean? And I guess that's that. That's how I feel about it, is, hey, you signed it, so...
Yeah, and that's the reality. There's not much you can do about it. So I think that's we've hit our end. So with the end, thank you both for coming on, and hopefully we can get the ball rolling with this and at least do this once a month and sit down and talk about video games and anything and everything that comes to mind. I didn't think we'd be talking about Japanese culture the way we did, so that was a pleasant surprise. So thank you both for coming on. Jesse, Anthony, any final thoughts before we sign off?
I'm excited for what's to come in the video game world, and I'm excited to see what they do and what's going to happen with new games and how one-player games are coming out now. Yeah. And see if they have a rise again. So I'm pretty excited.
Jesse, anything from you?
I'm a little bit excited in a certain way for Fallout 76.
Oh, because that's a conversation we can have later. I'm skeptical.
Well, here's the thing. I like co-op games, but I think Bethesda is just testing the waters in terms of their games being co-op.
Okay, well, no, I disagree. They've already tested the waters.
No, not with Elder Scrolls Online. I think that was just them going, hey, let's make a World of Warcraft ripoff because everybody else has.
No.
I mean a single-player game that has co-op elements in it. The way Fable did it.
We can talk about Fallout 76 another time. And
yeah, we'll save that. We'll save those for the chamber, because we'll definitely be back. Social media. Any social media you guys want to plug for yourselves?
You can follow me on Instagram. I recently changed it because it's the month of October and it's my favorite month, so I'm pretty sure I changed it to Spoopy Wizard. I recall.
I think so. I think I saw you make that change.
Yeah.
Jesse, any social media that people can follow you on, get your opinion on life in general, ask you questions, anything like that?
Follow me on Twitter, Jesse Karloff, I think, or is it Jerby? I don't even know my own Twitter handle.
It'll be in the link in the description below.
Yeah, just there'll be links to this to my social media, my Twitter and Instagram, I guess. I hate doing this.
Also, really quickly with you, Jesse, everybody, don't forget to follow Jesse's model page. He is a model on Instagram.
Do not follow my model page.
His model page is Jerby's Destruction. I definitely recommend it. There's a lot of gems on there. He is probably one of the greatest Instagram models to exist. So
shut up. No, I'm not. I'm not a model whatsoever.
Follow him.
His career is, you can get on the ground floor of his career before he really takes off. Eventually, it'll just be me and Anthony on this podcast, and Jesse will be too big. He'll be in Milan, Italy, and he'll be walking runways. It'll be massive. Right, Jesse?
I do not. It's too hot there.
Well, that's that.
And as always, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. The links will be down below. And make sure you check out everything that WeTalk does. From WeTalk Podcast, from their wrestling to their Electric Boogaloo to Fresh Take. Everything that WeTalk does is fantastic. So you have a bunch of content to choose from there. So make sure you follow them and check them out. For Anthony Torres, for Jesse Mulley, I'm Joel Johnson. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another good podcast.